It's the Masters, the season's first major, a tradition unlike any other, and a time for players to outperform even their own high expectations. This takes focus, commitment, and trusting the best golf ball for your game. That's why the majority at Augusta National will rely on the Titleist Pro V1 or Pro V1X. They deliver superior performance, consistency, and unrivaled control. Titleist, the number one ball at the Masters, the number one ball in golf.
Hello and welcome to episode 116 of The Thing About Golf, Golf Australia Magazine's ongoing quest to find out what draws so many people so deeply into this simple stick and ball game. Rod Murray's my name, and in this special 2024 Masters Week, John Huggan is bringing us some in-depth chats with some of the most interesting and intelligent people in the game. Yesterday, we heard from two-time Masters winner Ben Crenshaw. But today, it's a guest from a bit closer to home in the hot seat, 1991 Open champion and longtime TV commentator Ian Baker Finch. Baker Finch is one of the most popular people in golf, and after this delightful chat with Huggy, I think you'll have a bit more understanding of why.
Okay, welcome to the second edition of the special Masters Thing About Golf podcast. My guest today is a major champion, no less, Ian Baker Finch. What was and is the thing about golf for you?
John, great to be with you. It's many, many years of talking with you.
The pleasure is mine.
Please. Oh, it's always good to be with you, mate. And I've enjoyed listening to a lot of your podcasts. Very, very good. Back home in Australia over here.
I'm glad you're enjoying them.
I am. I enjoyed it. I know a bunch of the people that you've done in the last year. Yeah. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. And they've survived, all of them.
Yeah, exactly. The thing about golf for me, boy,
it's a deep question
if you're allowed to be. It'd be very easy to just say, hey, it's a game for life. It's a game that really, for me, has just been something so special in so many different aspects of my life. Are really because of this great game and how it all started and how I got to play and just where I came from was very, very different. Grew up in a very small little place. There was 35 children in my primary school. That's grade 1 to grade 7. There was 35 kids.
So I was one about twice that size, and I thought that was small.
Right? It's amazing, isn't it? Most of us didn't wear shoes. Yeah. Some of the kids rode horses to school. You know, I'd walked a mile or two. Anyway, so it started from nowhere, up in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. And my dad and a couple of other farmers in the area got to experience the Big Three and Arnold Palmer more than anything through those mid-60s.
Yeah.
And saw a little bit on TV, but read about him, and they decided that they'd take up this game. And as you know, Arnold Palmer was a working class man. You know,
his dad was the greenkeeper.
Yeah, exactly. He had a cigarette in his mouth all the time. Big, strong guy, and so they sort of gravitated towards that and started to play. And then my dad, sort of late 60s, I was 7 or 8 years of age. It was about 15 miles over to this club, and they'd play 9 holes on a Wednesday afternoon late in the day, have a couple of beers and drive home. And they decided to build a golf course in our area. Nice. So my dad went to the forestry department and said, look, we really would like to start a golf course. It'll be attached to the Returned Servicemen's League Club in Biewa, which was 6 miles from our country home farm. And the forestry department donated 100 acres in the middle of pine forests. Was surrounded by pine forests in our area for the paper mills. And it was just a grey, swampy 100 acres, and they decided to build their own course. Mm. So the thing about golf for me started back then when no one thought about golf, right? And we didn't know what it was. And in fact, when I went to high school as a 12-year-old in grade 8, I was the only one that played golf. And I won the Queensland, my state schoolboy title that year as a 12-year-old. And they then, the next year, started a golf program at our school.
Right.
So it really started where I would drive down on the tractor with my dad and his mates, and we built this little 9-hole course called Biewa Golf Club. Mm-hmm. And it's up on the Sunshine Coast now. It's a beautiful golf club, and it's now 18 holes. John Mellish is the pro. He's been there for over 30 years. He does a great job of running the place. But from those humble beginnings of playing up and down, up and down, up and down, little nine-hole course, you know, caddying for my dad, getting a love of the game, playing with his clubs. Got my first set of clubs when I was 12. It was a 3-5-7 iron, a putter, and a 2-wood in a little bag like this.
Sounds familiar.
And then I started working on the farms around the area to earn some money to add to those clubs. So I eventually built a full set.
Right.
And anyway, I could go on and on about those early days of how it started.
Yeah, you've actually
to now
got
where
in,
I am.
You've got that in common with Padraig Harrington. His father was a policeman in Dublin and helped to build the Stackstown Golf Club in Dublin where Padraig grew up.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the same kind of, you know, that's where he got to play because his dad was involved.
Yeah, and it's, so. in as I said, in my era, no one knew anything about golf. And my buddies had come over when I was, you know, in grade 7 or grade 8 or whatever, and they'd look at a golf ball and a club and they'd kind of had no idea what they were doing, but were sort of amazed that I could hit this ball between the chook sheds and down over the shed down there. And I started to play and got really good. And I was always a big kid. And so I excelled at all the sports, not necessarily because I was good, but it was because I was a foot taller. And, when at that age. But then at 15, I stopped playing tennis, soccer, cricket, which I loved. Loved cricket. And then anyway,
what were you at cricket?
Fast bowler. Right. Well, I was actually medium slow, but I thought it was fast.
Yeah.
Interesting story to that, on our C grade under 15 team was Steve Irwin. Steve Irwin was a couple of years younger than me, and good friends of mine, Ian Elks, who's now a member of the RNA and has maybe going to be president of Royal Queensland sometime soon, but he was on that team as well and reminds me of all the great stories about Steve. And he used to catch snakes. You know, he'd get a duck and he'd go into the bush and go catch snakes back then. But anyway.
So when did it become clear that you were exceptional?
I was exceptional in a country area at a country course winning the club championship.
Yeah, you would have to move on from that, obviously.
Yes. Yeah. And when I compared the only time I ever won anything as a junior was when I was in the age group below Peter Senior, because Peter Senior won everything.
Right.
And he was a year and a bit, year and a half older than me. Mm. So I won the under 13s schoolboys when he won the under 15s. Right. And then I won the under 15s when he went to the Open, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was never really as good as him. Or Wayne Grady or Greg Norman or any of the guys that grew up in Queensland. It's amazing when you look back. Since Greg won the Open in 86, there's 20 major championships from Queenslanders since then. Yeah. It's pretty amazing. Yeah, yeah. And we grew up on crappy golf courses, basically.
Right.
You know, and that's why we became good players.
That's certainly true in Scotland as well. You see it at lower level, but you're talking about the amateur team. They don't come from the big famous golf clubs. They come from little, you know, 9-holers or 18-hole short courses. It's amazing how that happens. I have no explanation for it, but maybe it's desire comes into it. I don't know.
Desire and dreaming about maybe, you know, one day playing on those great courses that we see on TV or playing with those great players or this for the Open, right?
And you're one of the, you know, the generation that you started in the pro shop. As an assistant, you know, and moved on up from there. I mean, Peter Fowler, I know, did the same, and, you know, other guys of that, you know, same age group as you.
That's right. And it was an opportunity to leave school early and get an apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a you know, the PGA of Australia is an RTO, registered training office. And I left school at 15, turned pro on July 1 of 76. I was 15 and a half, did my three-year apprenticeship. Finished my three-year apprenticeship mid-79 and went off and played. And my college years, if you bring in like a US example, that 18 to 22, when everyone just goes and has fun and competes against their buddies and has a great time, well, my college years, 18 to 21, 22, was playing the Australian Tour, the Sunshine Circuit, which was a bunch of pro-ams through the winter time, and playing on pretty average golf courses most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't really ever played a good golf course till I went to Melbourne in 1979, and I got to play down there in the Victorian PGA and actually saw what a golf course was and greens,
proper golf courses,
greens that weren't Bermuda.
Yeah,
And that my love of the game really grew then when I got to see the Sandbelt and see how marvelous
you would be of that the same the Australian generation, Mike Clayton and Fowler and the rest of them,
yes,
who went to Europe.
Yes.
That was where everybody went. Not many, there were exceptions, but not many went to America first.
No, you never.
Why do you think that was?
I don't think we thought we were good enough. Australians are pretty humble, as you know, being a Scot. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And we sort of tend to follow in the footsteps of those before us, and very few were good enough to go to the US tour. They started in Europe. Marshy and Gailey and Tomo played in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I eventually went to Japan and played there and loved it before I came to the US. But the US was always the shining light. Yeah. That's where the money was.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that a lot of people don't realize, when they talk about how the tour has taken over a lot from the smaller tours, it's really mainly because of the money. It's not that they've downtrodden the other tours. It's more the fact that in Australia we play in some tournaments for $250,000 total purse, and the winner's getting, you know, 40, 50 grand. Over here, they're playing for $20 million in some weeks.
Yeah.
The money discrepancy is so huge. When I was playing in the 80s and 90s, the money wasn't big at all. We had to keep playing. Yeah. Some years I played 40 tournaments because I did it for a living.
Yeah.
Obviously, I wanted to win and be a star and eventually win a major and win the Open, whatever. Yeah. But
I mean, your generation laughs at the guys that now, where they take, well, I must have any time off. I can't possibly play 3 weeks in a row. You know, I mean,
it's crazy.
It's weird, isn't it?
I don't get it. I got 13 starts on the European Tour in 84. Mike Clayton, Wayne Grady, and I were all managed by Wheatley Sport, which was Steve Fraser and Glenn Wheatley. Both, unfortunately, have recently passed away.
I heard from Mike Clayton just this morning. He tells me that it's the funeral.
Last night. For Steve. Yeah. Hundreds of people were there. He was a great man and really a big part of those 80s. How about picking three players and picking Mike Clayton, myself, and Wayne Grady to manage
when we were no ones? Not bad.
Right?
Yeah, I hope Mike's listening to this.
He will eventually.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we went. But the money, we did it for a living, and I would come home to play in Australia, and the money was maybe half as big in Australia as it was in Europe and maybe a third of the US. And, in fact, when I played in Japan from 85 to 88, I made more money in Japan in 88 than I did in the US when I won in 89. There was money was big in Japan and easier to win there.
Yeah.
So now the discrepancy is such that you have to get to the US as soon as you can. For me, it was more, and I don't want to jump ahead too much on that mid-80s, where I loved Europe. I played in Europe from 84 to 88, a little bit. And then I decided we were going to have a family. And when Jenny fell pregnant in 88, it was like, well, I need to go try the US tour again, because if we're going to travel as a family, which I wanted to do, I want to travel in the US. It's easier there. They have creches.
Yeah.
You know what it's like, and someone picks you up at the airport. We played in Europe for 5 years, and we loved it. We jumped in a van.
there was buses and all sorts.
Off to the hotel, and you'd scab a ride from somebody on the way to the course, you know, and vice versa.
Yeah.
It was fun, and we all stayed in the same hotels. And Jenny was one of the few girlfriends, wives, in the end, that traveled with me. There weren't many. Mostly it was guys. A lot of divorces.
Yes.
So I was very fortunate that I think I jumped ahead of the pack a little bit in those years because Jenny was with me. We were traveling together since 84 when I nearly won the Open or had a chance to win the Open.
I'm going to get to that in a bit. Yeah.
But it then was that progression as you started. Sorry, I digressed.
Yeah. Don't worry about that. Everybody digresses on this.
We went to Europe
and
that's where your buddies were and that's where we learnt, and it was great. We learnt. Went to St. Andrews, and I'm like, wow, this is a golf course, right? This is something exceptional. And I had Tomo show me around for 4 days. The next step was I didn't really want to go to Europe until maybe the PGA when the weather got a little better. I didn't like the cold weather coming from Queensland.
What's wrong with our weather? Come on.
It's not as bad as people make out, the summer's beautiful.
I've been telling people that it snowed where I live on Saturday, so I take your point.
It's difficult when you come from where I live in Australia. It's the same latitude south as I am in Florida north, right? It's 26 degrees, so it's pretty warm.
Yeah.
Anyway, I would then go from Australian end of February, I'd go up to Asia and then Japan on the way to Europe, back from Europe to Australia, play the Australian tour for 10 tournaments, 12 tournaments, whatever, then off again. And that was my progression. Then I decided I won in Japan, and it was good money, and I loved it. They were good people, suited my game. I was a very straight hitter, and they were very tight golf courses. So I played 3 years on the Japanese circuit, won a few times, and then went to the US when Haley was born, beginning of 89. I always thought that if I was going to get better, I had to play against the best players, which was also a decision to go to the US. I think I could have hung around in Japan and won a lot more times and easy time zone, easy travel.
Yeah.
But I don't think I ever would have won the Open if I hadn't gone to the US.
No, I mean, you've nicely gone into majors. I want to start with the Masters just because we're here and get into that. I mean, you competed at the and won at the very highest level. But I mean, let's start with the Masters. What was it? What's it like playing in the Masters for a start? Let's just make it as simple as that.
It's an honor to be invited or to earn your way in. I was invited in 85 because I'd played so well at the Open the year before. Back in those days, there was no world rankings. You had to be invited, and usually there was one or two Japanese, one or two Australians. Yeah. You know what it was like.
Yeah, yeah.
So 85, I didn't play very well. I had 10 3-putts, I remember, because the greens were so fast.
Yeah.
But it was
I thought
great.
You'd be all right in that, you know?
No, I don't know. I was always an aggressive putter. You know, it was 3 foot by, and I'd turn around and tap it back in, sort of thing. And I never really understood here the big laggers. Maybe I should have gone down to Royal Melbourne the week before and practiced on that putting green and sort of trained myself. But I came here all starry eyed, and I went away with the tail between my legs and thought, boy, that's a tough course. I better learn how to play there.
Is it as hard first time? I mean, you know, historically, you know, Fuzzy Zeller's the exception who won on his first visit. I mean, it seems to be – there is something to that, isn't there?
Yes.
It is hard to – you've got to learn this place.
Well, the last 44 champions have all played here at least once before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be hard. Wyndham Clark could break that this year.
Possibly.
The way he's playing.
Or Åberg.
Åberg, yeah. Oh, what a super young player.
Yeah.
Man. So it was great. And I was in the top 50 in the world rankings for the next 4 years and wasn't invited back because they didn't use the rankings until 1990.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So 86, 87. I was. but see, they had David Graham and Greg Norman were playing and Bruce Crampton probably still then in the 80s.
Maybe a stretch, not. Maybe.
But they didn't need to invite another Australian. And in fact, interesting, in 1986 – both Roger and I were in the top 25, I think, in the world rankings. I think that was the first year they became official and Bernhard Langer was number one.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we're both pretty high up, didn't get invited. But in 1991, I was 11th in the world rankings and Roger was 10th and Roger didn't get an invite. I was exempt.
Yeah.
But see, they still didn't. Yeah. It was amazing. I'm pretty sure that was one of the years.
Yeah, they weren't the most outward looking for a long time. I mean, I'd go back to 1980 when Seve won. Mm. There was four Europeans in the field, and one of them was an amateur. You know, it just wasn't happening at that point.
You know, this year, and you know all the stats as I do, I've been reading them ad nauseum for the last week, 46 Americans, 43 foreigners. Mm, yeah. So of the 89 players this week, it's a pretty even balance.
They've fixed the problem.
They do a great job. Yeah. They really do. I'd like to see more players play. I'd like to see it more like the other majors, maybe 120. But they've kept it the way it's meant to be. They invite the Asia Pacific amateur champion, the South American, Latin American, that the Masters does a great job of trying to advance the game in all corners of the globe. The drive, chip and putt, they do all of that sort of stuff. Yeah. Once again, I digress on that. But they try to do as good a job as anybody at getting the right field. The winners, you know, was a big week last week. Akshay Bhatia was striving to win in that playoff to make his way to the Masters. It's a huge thing. And that's how I felt. I remember going on all the daytime shows back home when I was just young and getting my first invite. It was a big deal for this young Australian kid to be invited to the Masters.
Yeah.
And I still feel that way. It's a special week, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's coming back to this.
What sort of advice would you give? I mean, you've seen the Masters now. You've played in it often enough. You've experienced the golf course, and you've watched it up close like few others have for the last few years as a commentator. What advice is the best advice to give the newbies, if you like?
Mm.
There's so much you could go into, I would think.
Yeah, it could be an hour podcast just on its own, couldn't it?
Yeah.
But the first thing, and it was almost like I was the captain of the Olympic team in Rio in 16 and Tokyo in 21, trying to get the team to understand that, hey, you're an Olympian. I really want you to experience this amazing feat that you've achieved and this amazing week and this whole thing, the biggest sporting event in the world every 4 years. But at the same time, I want you to treat it like a major. I want you to get in on Sunday night and we're going to leave after we've won the medal. And right. It's hard to do both, isn't it?
Yeah, but interesting you use that phrase, treat it like a major, because you hear, which it's absolute guff from players saying, oh, it's just going to be like another week. Well, no, it isn't. Don't be silly. Don't even think of telling us that, you know. But how do you treat it like a major? What does that actually mean?
I think be really, really well prepared when you arrive. And be prepared for everything, whether that means speaking to a few older guys that have experienced. It's not just talking to your coach and understanding the shots that you're going to need to hit. You've probably already learned that from watching it as a kid for 20 years. Mm. But it's really being prepared. I've always said you never come into a major championship with your B or C game and expect to win. You really need to bring your A game with you if you're going to win. Good.
Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm glancing at my battery just to see that it's enough. We've got enough power. That's all. Oh, so we're okay. Fine. Yeah.
I think be prepared for whatever it throws at you. It's going to be tough. It's going to be a grind. It's not, hey, go have fun today. It is not fun. You are grinding your ass off. Mm. You've got game face on. You need to be like Nick Faldo and Greg Norman and Curtis Strange and the guys that did so well at focusing. Obviously, Phil Mickelson, he looks like he's got that supercilious smile all the time and waving to the crowd, but he is so switched in. And Brooks Koepka, he's a killer when it comes to majors. That's what I'd be telling people, youngsters coming in.
Yeah.
Just be prepared. You're going to be uncomfortable. You're going to be uncomfortable on the first tee. Tiger Woods couldn't hit it on the world off the first tee at the Masters, right?
He's hit some incredibly bad first tee shots.
Unbelievable.
All over the world.
He nearly hit it on 8 green.
Well, he hit it left into the burn of the first tee at Carnoustie with an iron.
Mm.
I mean, inexplicable for somebody that good to be that bad at
right.
first tees.
And it's, yeah. I'm sure, having never played, and obviously being Australian, never would play in the Ryder Cup, mm-hmm. but I would think the pressure of being on yeah. that team and on the
that's
first tee.
That's what everyone says, yeah.
I can't imagine how much they might. Yeah. And that's why the players that play well in the majors continue to play well in the majors, and those that play well at the Ryder Cup or President's Cup to some extent continue to do well and yeah. get better because they've experienced baptism by fire.
Right. Okay, here's right. the thing. I did a piece this week for Golf Australia, the magazine,
mm-hmm.
looking at the Australian record here at Augusta.
Yes.
One win, there's been, I think it was 297 starts by 53 Australians have played in the Masters. One win, that's like 0.33% success rate on a golf course that on paper should suit to an extent guys who've grown up in Australia, mm. played Royal Melbourne, Kingston Heath and all the rest of it. There's a similarity there. And yet, Adam Scott remains the only one.
Mm.
I need an explanation. You know, and your record here, I'm looking at your record in the Masters, 3 top 10s.
Mm.
I mean, you know, that's kind of
and I never
over
well.
Par for you because on the way you played and the way you putted especially mm. to do well here. I don't understand there's definitely a mental aspect to this, but what do you think?
Until Adam won, it was certainly a huge mental bridge to overcome, right? It was
well, it was the one sporting event that Australia had never won.
Correct.
You know, they'd won almost everything else.
And it was so huge for Scotty to win. And he said, hey, we're a proud Australian sporting nation, you know, and I feel so honoured to put the green jacket on. It's amazing how, well, obviously Greg had so many close chances and opportunities and couldn't get it done, which sort of increased that aura, didn't it? Because there were so many
the
times.
The way he lost as well, especially. Yes. That put pressure on the others, I think.
87 with Larry Mize. And then 89, he had another chance after Nick Faldo beat him in 96.
Yeah.
99, I should say. Yeah. 88, 89, he had chances. 86 with Jack, he was right there.
Exactly.
Just blew his second shot right.
That,
so many chances.
Perversely, that put more pressure on the guys coming along behind.
I think so.
Yeah.
And maybe we're all searching for too much. Maybe there's something that we deep down think that we're missing. I don't know what that is because, as you say, we know what fast greens are like playing in the sand belt in Melbourne.
Yeah,
we don't play many hilly courses like this. Royal is rolling, but it's not really It's undulating, isn't it? It's not really hilly.
But the greens are the thing here.
Mm.
That's the big. I mean, people. Everyone says it's the. That's the biggest protection against scoring. Is the green complexes that should have played right into Australia's or you'd, most you'd Australians'
think,
hands. You'd
but,
think.
But you know, if you look at all of the past champions, half of them are bad putters.
Yeah, well, but then the greens haven't been this quick for that, you know.
Correct.
You look back at the 1970s and they're ramming putts.
Mm, yes, I've been looked at a lot of the old
it's
movies.
It's weird, isn't it?
But if you think about Langer was a great let's put it this way. I think Scotty, long putter, first one to win with a long putter, first one to win a major. Yeah. He became a great lag putter. Tiger Woods, great putter, but great lag putter. Phil Mickelson, great lag putter. Bernhard Langer. If you think about some bad putters that have won, I don't think Trevor Immelman was a great putter.
No.
Angel Cabrera. Mm. There's a bunch, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's more about ball striking here. You better be top 10 in the world in ball striking to win here, because the greens are difficult. Where the hole locations are, you've got to hit it into sort of one quarter of the green. That's the only opportunity you have, or it caroms off to wherever. So I really think ball striking is the number one thing here, and taking advantage of the fives. You just have to. That's what Alistair McKenzie and Bobby Jones did so well with this course, is they made the course wide to encourage the big hit, to encourage the let's go for it, get it into the correct side of the fairway, like Lynx Golf, for that particular hole location of the day. I think he did a great job of that. So yes, being a long hitter is a big help. Especially now at 7,600 yards.
They're all long hitters, though.
They are. You're right. Yeah. I mean, it's over half the field flies at over 300 yards.
I mean, we did the podcast yesterday with Ben Crenshaw, and I asked him this question, and I said, I'm going to ask everybody this week that on the podcast, and I'll ask you. I did a story recently, Maurice Bembridge, English, very short hitter.
Yes.
Wonderful
to player.
Nice, beautiful golfer.
About eight Ryder Cups or something?
Well, half a dozen.
Anyway,
he shot 64 here in the last round in 1974. Now, my point is that the Maurice Bembridge of today couldn't shoot 64 on this golf course. And that diminishes, I think the game's gone backwards because of that. What do you think on that subject?
I agree 100%. Yeah. I think the rollback is too little too late. Oh, yeah. I really do. I think it's got out of control. People say, oh no, everyone wants to see everyone hit it far. I'm like, the 350-yard hitter is still going to hit it 330. He's still going to hit it plenty far. They've made golf only for the big hitters. Mm-hmm.
At the top level.
Yeah. I looked at the young fellow that lost, unfortunately, in the playoff last week with Akshay, Denny McCarthy. Mm-hmm. It's like a six-cylinder engine against the 12-cylinder engines when you watch him. Mm-hmm. If he had been playing in the 70s and 80s, he'd be a top five player in the world. Right. He is so good. Mm. He is so good. But he can only hit at 295, only, right? And I think the game is now at a point where if you can't swing it at 118 to 120, like at least the big hitters are 130 mile per hour. If you don't have 178 to 182 ball speed, for those that are understanding all the numbers these days, the younger listeners, you have no chance. And so if you're only an average, if you're only 173, 174, you're going to struggle. You better pick your schedule to the courses that suit you.
And that place, this place here is you've seen – you've watched it up close, as I said, you know, over the years. Have you been aware of the gradual – You have to be longer and longer.
I think so. Yeah. Well, it really helps when the greens are as hard and as fast as they are. There's something that's never really talked about, certainly never talked about here. It's taboo to mention green speeds. I've been doing the CBS telecast now for 18 years.
I was going to ask you what you can't mention
green speeds. Yeah. Last year I got a rap over the knuckles for saying they were the slowest I'd ever seen them because the humidity was so high.
Right.
Well, I wasn't being derogatory to the course or the greens. It was just the humidity was so high. The greens were probably only 12 on the stim meter, instead of 14.
Yeah. The
advantage is to hit the ball as far as possible and fire into the greens with a short iron as high as possible. Tiger showed us that.
Yeah.
Everyone's now, that's how they play. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way you can really get it to stay on the greens when they get hard and fast. We'll see it this weekend, maybe not Thursday, Friday, because we're getting rain, but the weekend when it gets windy and cools off and no humidity, they get like glass.
Yeah. I mean, I think here more than anywhere else, because it's the same place every year and the science that they've made of this place, I think they can almost tell you what the winning score is going to be within a shot on Wednesday. You know, is that, do you share that? I mean,
they can certainly manufacture the course, they can tailor make it to what they want daily with hole locations. Yeah. They'll have, we're sitting at a table that's probably 1.5 meters by 1 meter. That's the hole location. And they can shift it to here right on the edge if the greens are holding and there's no wind. Yeah. And they'll have it there on the day when the greens are really hard and fast and it's windy.
Yeah.
So they'll give you an opportunity to get it to that little place on the tough days, but they'll make it a bit tougher on the easy days. So, yes, they have the sub-air under all the greens so they can get rid of all the moisture.
Yeah.
But the course really is, and one of the reasons we started on this, it's so immaculate.
Mm.
I have friends come from Australia and they brush the grass. Is this real?
Now, you see, I have a thing about that as well. I'm maybe a bit perverse, and people would probably confirm that, but I don't think golf courses should be immaculate. I think the game loses a bit of its randomness if it's, you know, the conditions are so perfect that you're never going to get, oh, he's got a dodgy lie there. Well, I know he can hit a great shot. These great players of great, easy, perfect lies. I know they can do that, but how are you good if a little cuppy, you know, in a halfway divot and downhill and, you know.
That's
I
how
want
we
to
grew
see
up.
That. I want to see that.
Right. You know? But that's how we grew up, didn't we? We never had anything that wasn't a dodgy, right?
Yeah, I know, but it's gone.
It's in some ways, you would say, and I have to be careful how I say this because I respect this place immensely, 100%. But people have been watching this on CBS for over 60 years now, and they thought that this was how golf should be.
Yeah.
Now, understand that this is Bermuda base, overseeded with ryegrass, the best week of the year for growth in the spring. All the azaleas are coming through, the dogwoods, everything's blooming. The ryegrass has had, they do it in October, November, so it's had 4 or 5 months to grow. It's now a tight knit. It's a carpet. Mm. So the course is manufactured to be perfect. The sand in the bunkers, just pristine white. Everything's perfect. That's why people look at it and say, wow, I've got to go to Augusta National. I've got to get to the Masters. I've got to see that place. Yeah. It looks like golfing heaven.
I get it.
And it is golfing heaven. But I prefer, personally, the Open because it's nuanced. It's conditions-driven. Usually it's hard and fast because it's the middle of summer. It's not contrived in any way. Yeah. If you've had a wet summer, it might be longer, rough, and tougher.
Yeah.
But it's made for TV golf in that it is absolutely perfect. And you watch on CBS here in the States and around the world and in high def, it can't be any more perfect, can it?
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, I'm not knocking it because it is what it is. But that I'm like you, my preference would be for something that, you know, I want to see Ian Baker finish at the top of his game playing from a dodgy lie.
Mm.
See how good you really are.
And I could get on my high horse a little bit about green speeds and whatever. I love firm, fast greens. But if the greens are faster than 12, it can be a little silly, especially if it gets windy, which is another reason why I think I did better when the greens weren't as fast. As much as I was a good putter, I think I was better when I had to give it a hit rather than lagging and taking the big parabolas.
I've always thought, I mean, see what you know far more about putting than I do, but I grew up on a Scottish links where the greens were really quite pretty fast in East Lothian. And I always thought that I was very poor putter on slow greens because of that.
Mm.
But that I thought, looking back on it now, I think my technique was found out a little bit. Do you not?
Yes.
It means that you've got to have a better technique on slow greens because you've got to hit the ball out the middle of the putter to get the solid contact. Whereas on a fast green, you can get away with a bit more off the toe or the heel or whatever
and
not
be,
strike it perfectly.
100% agree with you. I think the best lag putters are the ones that do well on the really fast greens, the ones that are used to getting it close. I was more aggressive, and I actually would three putt more often from, say, 15 to 20 feet because I was trying to hold it.
Yeah.
And
Your expertise can work against you sometimes.
Yes.
Because you get overambitious. You know,
and it did because I'd say, no, I was from inside 4 feet, I was inside the cup always.
Right.
That's how firm I hit them. And here you can't be that way. Sometimes it might be a cup outside on a four-footer.
Yeah.
Very, very difficult to be disciplined enough to do that.
It's the Masters, the season's first major, a tradition unlike any other, and a time for players to outperform even their own high expectations. This takes focus, commitment, and trusting the best golf ball for your game. That's why the majority at Augusta National will rely on the Titleist Pro V1 or Pro V1X. They deliver superior performance, consistency, and unrivaled control. Titleist, the number one ball at the Masters, the number one ball in golf.
What are your favourite Masters moments that you've witnessed from up in the tower?
Oh, from the tower?
Yeah.
Oh, best tournament ever was Tiger Woods 2019. We joke often, the best television of the year or perhaps ever from Jim Nantz and Nick Faldo was the 2 minutes, 40 seconds they laid out after Tiger won. Mm. That television, that spectacle, that the excitement, the... Oh, I can't think of all of the words.
Yeah, some pictures don't need
words. The euphoria, yeah. Correct, of him winning and walking with the kids up to the, you know, to scoring and, you know, the clubhouse was just amazing. That was the biggest sporting achievement in my memory, not just Masters, not just golf, for Tiger Woods to come back and win in that way. And if you look at the guys that were second, you know, Brooks Koepka was right there, Dustin Johnson, Molinari, I believe, from memory. So, you know, there's a whole Tony Finau was there. There was a bunch of guys that were right there.
All the guys who hit it in the water on 12.
Four of the last couple of groups, three groups, whatever. So that was and it was an early finish that day. Remember we'd had rain?
There was a storm coming.
Yeah. So that was one of the most – for me, as a youngster, Jack Nicklaus winning in 75 – beating Miller and Weisskopf, I believe. Right. Another second for Tom.
Exactly.
That was amazing. And then, obviously, Jack again against Greg and Seve and Tom Kite, I believe, in 86. Mm-hmm. That was a memorable one, obviously.
Seve should have won that.
Seve chunked it in the water, well, hooked it in the water at 15.
Yeah, inexplicably. Yeah.
For him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were big moments for me, memory. I wasn't here in 86. I played in 85. I didn't play 86, 7, 8, 9, even though I was playing well. I watched from afar. Probably played in Japan. And then as an announcer, I've been coming here for over 25 years as an announcer. I did the Australian TV for 8 years and then CBS now for 18 years, so a long time. Mm. Seen some great moments, some fantastic wins. Sandy in 88, you know, making the birdie out of the bunker at 18. Nick winning. You know, back-to-back in 89, 90. Yeah, there's some good times. 91, 92, I had good chances both times, and I just didn't putt well on the Sunday. Second to last group in 92, played with Raymond Floyd, and I really struck it well, and I watched Raymond chip in from nowhere a couple of times, and I'm like, God, if only I could do that, I could win this thing. You know?
He did that a lot. Yeah.
Oh, boy. He chipped in from the front right of 14.
Wow.
Chipped into that pin, sort of on the shelf.
Yeah.
Unbelievable chip. Yeah. Best chip I've ever seen. Yeah. He hit a back foot lob wedge, or high lofted wedge, into the bank really, really hard, ball out of balls. One bounce onto the ledge, spun 20 foot right into the hole. Mm. It was unbelievable shot.
Yeah.
That same day, he had pitched in from the front of three.
Whoa. Yeah.
You know, if you can get that up and down in three, you've done well, let alone hole it.
Yeah.
So anyway, he did well. He finished second to in 92. That was Fred Couples' year. But anyway, they were a couple of times I had a chance, 91, 92. But the last 25 years watching it, just the Tiger wins. Mm-hmm. I missed his first one. I wasn't doing TV that year. Might have been the last year. Last year I played was 96 when Greg
won. Not that people are that interested in what I've got to say here, but I did two Masters as a newspaper, daily newspaper correspondent for paper in Scotland, 96 and 97.
Oh.
Which were two.
Unbelievable.
It always makes me laugh. I tell this story a lot. Like everybody else, I basically had my story written in 96. You know, Greg Norman wins, blah, blah, blah. Everybody was, at first they were sitting back, you know, feet up, watching the golf. And then as it evolved, and by the end, there was this frenzy of rewriting going on, you know, and I was part of it, you know.
Sure.
It's funny to watch, you know.
Wasn't it? It was sad, wasn't
it? Well, it was funny to watch in the media center. It wasn't funny to watch on the golf course. It was certainly for Australia heartbreaking.
Oh, wow. Because, you know, that the second shot at eight was the start of it.
Yeah, the re-gripping, all that, yeah.
Because he wasn't comfortable with his grip all week, really. First couple of days he was great. And then he was re-gripping and just couldn't quite get comfortable with his grip pressure all day. And that started it. You know, you can't go left at eight. Yeah. And then,
As we're talking about it, I want to talk more about you, you know, certainly winning the Open and your experiences, you know, after that. Greg Norman, right now, has he? What's he done to his legacy in the game? Where do you stand on all this LIV Golf stuff, and what's your hope for the future, kind of thing?
Well, obviously, like everybody, my hope for the future is they sort it all out. I don't think it's just as simple as is the PIF fund going to give the US Tour some money. So that doesn't solve the problem.
There needs compromise on all sides, I think, somewhere. You
know. Yeah. I thought John Rahm had an interesting comment in the last week about, hey, if we just changed it to 72 holes, maybe there's a better chance of this.
Well, they would.
It's never going to be a merger.
It'd be easier for world ranking points if they did that. You
know. Well, I think they could get world ranking points even as 54 holes if they had a better way onto the tour and a better way off the tour.
I've said this before. I'd just get rid of the world rankings. I don't think you can possibly, if you're playing in America and I'm playing in Europe and different weather, different courses, I mean, what can you possibly compare the two? It doesn't make, I don't understand statistics, but enough to say that that doesn't work, but it seems to me illogical.
It's definitely
that you can compare.
It's definitely difficult to get the right formula, and they've tried 10 different formulas over the 40 years.
Yeah. I'd just get rid of them and let the only the people that care about them are the majors. And they can fill up their fields. They did perfectly well before the world rankings came along.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't get to play in the Masters for a few years.
Yeah, I know. It was sad that they didn't have them then, but you can always look back, can't
you? Yes.
Hindsight's 2020. I think they need to find a better way. And I don't think it's as simple as the world rankings. I just don't think in Australia, the LIV event in Australia is extremely successful.
Yeah.
And it's huge for Australia because we're starved for an event or multiple events with all of the really good, well-known players. It's not all of the great players, but there's a lot of them there, a lot of major winners, a lot of people we know.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that's good, and that's good for Australian golf, and the Australian fans
love it. Well, Australia is one of the great tragedies. I mean, I've been a regular visitor, as you know, and it's just with the players that you've produced and the golf courses that you've got, it should be right up at the top level, you know.
It's just we don't have
a month every year. We've got
27 million people. And what we really need to do is co-sanction with Japan and Korea and the DP World and get more of those international sponsors to come, because our summer is Northern Hemisphere winter.
Yeah.
And we have 4 months of just exceptionally good weather, as you know, great golf courses, big crowds. It's a wonderful training ground.
It's a tragedy almost, you know. It's not a real tragedy, but it's a tragedy in golfing terms.
And that, as I said before, when the monies were a little more equivalent back in the 80s, even early 90s before the Tiger era, I would go home and play 10 tournaments at home because I wasn't missing something. You know, the wraparound tour wasn't good for Australian golf, the wraparound tour and the US tour, because they could play for $10 million over in the States. Why would they come home and play for $1 million? So they stayed and played, so we missed a lot of our good players.
Yeah.
And to get international stars, we had to pay them to come, high taxes, all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's not going to be fixed overnight. But back to LIV, I don't think LIV as we know it will be around in a couple of years.
No. I mean, I stick to Norman for a minute. I worry for him that he's rewritten the first paragraph of his obit. It's not going to be what a great player he was in the Opens that he won. It's going to be, you know, about LIV and what he did, right? Whether you think it's right or wrong, how he's behaved or what he's done. That to me is a shame. You know, because that's what's going to happen.
Because he was the best player in the world or one of the top three players in the world for a decade. Amazing player, great ability.
Yeah.
And he just had a beer in his bonnet about he wanted the great players to be able to play regularly, and that was a bit more of a US-European tour thing at the time. I don't know whether, no matter what comes out at the end of this, if we all had a crystal ball and could say, I've got my own ideas on it, but I don't think the best players in the world, say you got the top 50 best players in the world, they are not going to travel around the world playing against each other every week. It's just never going to happen. So we should even stop talking about it, because that's not going to happen.
You don't need them all, though. You just need enough of them.
Correct. You know. Correct. But it won't be all. It won't be like the majors. We have the four majors.
But then that's okay. I'm happy with that, for them to be set apart.
Yeah.
I like that.
Well, they are. It's the same in tennis.
Yeah.
Most people can't even name three or four other tennis tournaments. I know the one in Miami sits spectacular, and the one in the desert in Palm Springs is wonderful. And, you know, so there's other events that are big. But the four tournaments, the four majors are the big ones. The Ryder Cup, of course, is the fantastic spectacle and the biggest of all. But the idea that all of these American-born players are going to travel the world and play a world tour when they've lived in America and gone home every night to Dallas or Atlanta or Scottsdale or Palm Beach Gardens, that's not going to happen. And you've seen that with LIV. The majority of the players that have gone there are non-American players that have always traveled their whole life, especially South Africans and Australians. I mean, you're home for 3 or 4 months and then you travel for the 8 or 9 months, just part of our DNA.
Yeah.
So I think a real world tour will have to be a little different to what they're trying to imagine now. And I think the US tour will always remain US-centric, and it'll have the number one sponsor is US television, $750 million a year from CBS and NBC and Golf Channel and whatever. So they don't want to have tournaments around the world that aren't on US time zone.
Middle of the night, yeah.
Right? So I don't really know how a world tour, as we all think of it, Rory's had some great ideas, but they're wonderful ideas, but you're looking through rose-coloured glasses.
Yeah.
The best 50 players in the world aren't going to go to the Japan Open, the Australian Open, the South African Open, the European PGA. They're just not going to do it.
I know. More right? of a pity.
Yeah. It is. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a way forward. It's just deciding on what that end will look like. And I don't think it's as simple as, you know, and I'm probably getting in a bit too deep here, might be saying the wrong thing, but I don't think it's as simple as is the Saudi fund going to help fund the USPGA tour and not fund LIV, and then everything's going to be rosy. Mm. But it's not as simple as that. It's tough, and we need those smart guys at the front show us the pathway.
I've asked you this question, and it's maybe slightly unfair, but where do you stand on the source of the money?
I dislike the 180 degree turn.
Yeah, I've said this before, you know, on here. I think Monaghan made a mistake. Was he made it a moral thing?
Yep.
He didn't make it a business. It's like the you know, the Corleone family and the Godfather. It's not personal. It's business.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to take that attitude, whether rightly or wrongly. You know, you have to put the moral stuff aside because the business world deals with Saudi.
We're all watching Formula One.
Everybody,
that's where the money comes from.
Yeah, everybody.
We're all watching European soccer.
And I get, you know, what Brando Chambly and Eamon Lynch and, you know.
I understand that too.
I get that. But
the worst thing though, right? The way it was handled at the start was the bad thing. If they'd all sat down at the start,
yeah,
we wouldn't be in the soup that we're in.
Yeah.
But hey, once again, hindsight. It's difficult to.
Anyway, I don't want to dwell on this too much because I think people who listen to these
they're probably over.
I have to ask.
I'm over about all the money. Everyone's sick and tired of all the money talk.
I know, and they're doing damage. You know, the viewing figures.
I want some of those. Let me just say this. I want a large percentage, more than half of all of that money, to go to grassroots.
Mm.
Go to junior programs, boys and girls together, all over the world. The Saudi fund could buy golf with all that money around the world, not professional golf. The millionaire golfers have all got enough money as it is, and they all think they're overrated. They're worth more is what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, they all think they're worth hundreds of millions
of dollars.
I don't know
why they said
their rankings aren't that.
They could buy women's golf. It'd be a great PR move.
But do it both through junior golf.
Yeah,
they don't need...
Yeah.
That's what I would love to see. If I was king, I'd be saying, okay, we're going to take that $3 billion. We're not going to give $1 billion of it to the PGA Tour players in equity.
Mm.
We're going to give that $1 billion to junior golf, and we're going to give – here's Australian Tour over there. You've been so good over the years of creating great players, men and women. Kari Webb, oh, my God, one of the top five players
ever.
She is, by far.
Yeah.
So I would like to see that. That's where I want the money spent. Let's really – you know, advance the game. I hate the term grow the game. It's not, but you know what I mean.
It's cliche.
For
all that I'm a little bit worried about Greg Norman, I've also been a wee bit worried about you in the sense that, you know, I think people are possibly through time, it just happens, you know, naturally, but they think of you as a commentator, not as an open champion. And I think of you as an open champion first. But that's because I'm older.
We saw the good times.
But yeah, how do you feel about that? I mean, is that the way it is? I mean, do you find that people, they think of you as the guy on CBS more than the guy who won the Open?
Yeah, I think the first couple of years that I struggled after I had been a good player for a decade or more, That was the hardest time for me because I felt like everyone thought that's how I played. Mm. But if you and I went and played, and we've played before, I know how good a player you are, and I'd go shoot in the 60s every time I played.
It was ridiculous how well you played. We played at Kingston Heath a few years ago, and I thought, well, it's not quite tour standard, but it's not a kick in the pants off it,
right?
You know, where you were then.
Yeah, that was the hardest thing for me. It was really. And I just say this, and then to get back to your question, it was really just one round that I played that I wished I could have back and never have played, and I would still have kept playing.
Is that the one at Troon?
Yes. Yeah. That broke me.
Yeah.
I guess. But now, even through my – and I know you've asked this question of other announcers on the show. I am a golfer. Mm. I'm a professional golfer. I happen to work for CBS. I've had a wonderful career, and I love working with my team. Jim Nantz, Nick Faldo for 16 years, now Trevor Immelman, Frank Nobilo, Doddy Pepper, Colt Nost, Funny Bugger, Mark Immelman, Amanda Balionis. We have such a good team. We are the Tiffany standard, they call it here in the States. We are the gold standard. No, I don't mean to downplay the others because they're all great at what they do, but our team is awesome, and I've had the great life of over 25 years of doing the TV. But I still see myself as a professional golfer, and I think the knock on me as an announcer is that I'm too soft on the players because I see how hard it is, how hard they've worked, and I know what it's like when you get a kick in the pants like I had at the end of my career. Yeah. So I kind of see it that way.
Ultimate kick in the pants, really.
Yeah. Yes. So anyway, I had an under par career until 94, and I think I had an over par career for the next 4 years that sort of balanced me out a bit.
Do you think the way it evolved for you would have gone the same way if he hadn't won the Open? Was there a kind of sense in you that you won the Open, the biggest event in golf in my mind, certainly, and did you look around and think you didn't compare with some of the other guys in the top 10 in the world, say?
Mm.
And was that the motivation for trying to change things or make it better? Or could you have gone, if you hadn't won the Open, would you have done what you did? That's what I'm
saying. I don't think so. I think
it's hypothetical, I know, but yes.
I was pretty cocky and full of myself. Top 10 in the world, won the Open. My goal then was to win the Masters, not the Grand Slam in a year, but to win all four majors. I thought I was good enough to win them all. I had a chance that year at Masters, had a chance the next year at the Masters, was runner-up at the Players' Championship. Mm. Won a couple of tournaments in Australia in between. So I really thought I would get better. And then I finished the year in 92, and this is so stupid. I wish I'd had better people around me to help me through these times. But I was 24th in the world rankings at the end of 92. I'd had a couple of top 10s in majors. I'd played well in all of them, second in the players, couple of wins. And I thought, God, what a terrible year. And I was... That's really when it started.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to tinker a little bit. 93, I slipped back even further. 94, the last top 10 in a major was the Masters here in 94. Never really played well after that. Mm-hmm. Tried to hit it farther. Could see that all of these guys that had now switched to a harder covered ball were now hitting it 20 yards past me instead of 10. And that was why I started to change things.
Yeah, but was all of that the result of raised expectations because you won the Open?
Well,
to get back to the original question.
I think I, in a way, yes, because I felt like I had to play that way all the time rather than think, hey, when I play my best, I can win. But I'm really here and I should just be happy with where I am. I'm one of the decent players in the world, but... I did think, you get starting to be paired as one of the key groups rather than just a part of a key group.
Yeah.
That was my goal, was to win the Open. I was always a goal setter. When I was younger, I listened to a lot of tapes, read hundreds of books. I love reading.
Okay.
So I...
And that was my big plan. Influence on you as well.
He was. Tomo was great. Yeah. He was such a big help.
Should you have talked more to him?
Yes.
Yeah.
I should have.
I think he would have put you off doing some of the things you did, I'm sure, by the sound of it anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when I did start to go see him a little bit more in 94, 95, I had already lost my own swing.
Mm.
So the simple things that Tomo's pearls of wisdom, those little things that he used to give me,
yeah.
I struggled to find because I had so many other swing thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. And few people had made the game simpler than he did.
Oh, he was so good for me.
Yeah.
That's why I got good. And a lot of people will blame the coaches that I went to see. It wasn't any one coach. It was just me trying to figure out what it was I needed to do to regain my old ability, not really find anything new. And then towards the end, the big regret, as I said, I shouldn't have played the Open at Troon in 97. I'd already sent my caddy home. I was about to, I was never going to play.
Yeah.
And everyone, all my mates were there, and they said, look, you've played 15 in a row. You got to play this one too. And I went and played, and I just shouldn't have played. Anyway, when I stopped playing after the Open in 96, I should have taken a medical extension. I should have said, I couldn't wear shoes for 3 months.
Right.
My feet were gone. I had to rehab my shoulders. I'd been hitting 100 drivers a day for 3 years.
Yeah.
I was a mess.
Yeah.
I should have taken a medical. I didn't even think about it. I thought, no, I'm exempt for 6 more years on the PGA Tour. I'll just take 6 months off. And I should have taken the medical. And then there was no rush for me to come back. I could have gone and tried to find my game, get over the health issues. And I worked for Australian TV that summer because I couldn't do anything else. Mm-hmm. I did all 12 tournaments, all 12 different producers, different networks, everything. You know what it's like.
Good
down there.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
I used to show up 5 minutes before. I spent 2 hours on the range with the guys,
mm-hmm.
came in, sat down, put the headsets on, and off we go. I was just a player talking golf. Well, then Jack Graham, God bless him, mm-hmm. from ABC over here in the States, called me and said, look, I hope you come back to play, but if you don't, you've got a job here. And I started with television, ESPN and ABC mainly here in 98. And that gave me an outlet that allowed me to get over the demise of, not playing well anymore. And I tried to get my game. I kept my game in good enough shape that I could go play occasionally if I wanted to.
Well, I saw that. I mean, it was...
But, I still play well. I still shoot in the 60s on good
days. I'm sure you do. I mean, you made it look pretty easy that day I played with you, that's for sure.
It's good fun. Well, you still play well too. You were a great player when you were young.
I haven't shot in more than a year.
Oh, really?
It's a mixture of... This is boring for people listening, but my back's not great and my ego's even worse.
That hurts.
I don't want to play because I play so badly now, so...
Yeah, that's how I felt for a year or two after shooting that score at the Open. You go shoot 20 over par and around.
Mm-hmm.
I'll save myself a little bit by saying it was Troon on a 40-mile-an-hour wind day. But,
Be tough.
There's a lot of lost balls.
Exactly. I think everybody who played at the top level must have been looking at you at that time and thinking, there but for the grace of God, because that could happen to anybody, And it's a tenuous business when
it
you
is.
Think about it.
Well, it's a confidence game.
Golfer.
As you know, it's a confidence game. And as I said, when I was cocky and winning and thinking that I could do this really well, I never thought about doing anything but playing golf and playing well, ever.
Yeah.
So when that happened, I'm like, oh, shit, what am I going to do now? And I was fortunate enough to get the TV gig, which has been really since that 96. What's that? 28, 29 years now I've been doing. So I've been a TV guy for longer.
Yeah.
Kids at home in Australia know me. They have no idea that I won the Open 30 years ago.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I didn't want to leave this subject without people, especially younger people who are not quite aware of how ridiculously well you played when you won the Open.
Mm.
I mean, it was nonsense. I mean, I thought you were going to go around to nothing on the last day.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazingly good.
It was good fun.
It wasn't as if you backed into it, that's for sure.
Oh, no. You don't have the lead in a major and shoot 29 the front nine and back into it.
Exactly. I don't want the younger people listening to this
to not realize this.
Yeah.
I had a couple of chances at St Andrews, as you know, in 84 and 90. I played in the last group on Sunday both times. So I learnt from watching and then played well enough in 91 to win.
What was the difference between you 1991 and 84?
Oh, just more experience. Yeah, it's funny, 84 I was confident that I would play well. I wasn't expecting to win. I was 23 in my first major.
Yeah.
But I got a little bit of a shock on the first green when my ball spun back from a depression in the front of the green that had been watered unnecessarily the night before because the greenkeeper had left the hose there.
Yeah.
He watched all day.
I remember that.
He told me I was the only player to hit it in there. It spun back in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bad start. And I'm like, oh, shit, I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
And it just unraveled, and I was playing with Tom Watson, and Tom was going for three in a row and six, and it was a big event.
Yeah.
But one of my great memories was standing on 17 green watching Seve.
Well, I was in the grandstand to the right as you play the first in the big grandstand to the right, the first tee.
Uh-huh.
I sat there all day. I watched you guys all tee off, and I watched you were still there when you came back.
Yeah, fantastic. Amazing. What a great one of the best opens ever.
Oh, that putt that Seve hold, I mean, literally everybody in the stand stood up.
Yep.
It's the most amazing thing.
Yeah, and then Tom walked up and paced off his second shot because he had to hold it.
That's right.
He could have bought my birdie. I birdied the last.
Well, problem was the second shot in 17.
Yes, he hit the 2-iron over the
green. Dave Marr's description of that was brilliant. It was the wrong shot with the wrong club at the wrong time.
Mm.
I mean, you can't beat that.
And that's correct.
Yeah.
And he knows it now.
Yeah.
Because he would nearly always have drawn the 3-iron in and bounced it up there, right? Mm. And instead he tried to fly it to the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that day? Everybody says, you know, it's a learning experience. You shot in the high 70s. I remember you holding a nice putt in the last green.
Yes. Yeah. I was top 10, but I'd blown myself out of it early.
Yeah.
I think it just gave me confidence that I could compete at a high level.
Mm.
Like I had played well in Australia, won some tournaments, was invited to the Open because I was top 5 in the money list or top whatever. And I played well enough to compete against the best players in the world. So that was really the time when I started to think I could win the Open rather than just be so happy that I'd achieved the ability to play in an Open, be exempt in an Open. So that was really the start of me being an international player and, you know, setting a plan. And but things were so much simpler then, John. You know, I didn't have any advice. I didn't have a coach. I didn't have a, you know, my girlfriend and I traveled away, you know, all starry-eyed thinking everything was going to be rosy.
It's a great life, I would imagine, for a young couple with no kids at that point.
Yes.
You know, just traveling the world, you know.
It was. Brilliant. It was traveling Europe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Great cities to visit, yeah.
Just fantastic.
Yeah,
very lucky. So that was the early period of my life, and I really have had a great life in golf. When I think back to what I was saying earlier about how I got started in golf, to then get to play in a British Open, to then get to win a British Open, to then eventually start working for TV.
Aaron, you're not going to be happy you calling it the British Open.
Well, it was called the British Open then.
I know it was, yeah. It's revisionist history.
Tom, I always used to call it that.
Yeah.
But I know it's funny now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the Open.
The Open.
Yes.
And then to captain the Olympic team a couple of times, get the sports medal in Australia, Sportsman of the Year, whatever.
Yeah, you've not done too badly for the wee boy from the farm in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, really. Mm. It's been amazing.
Yeah.
You know, when I think back, 63 now.
I know the feeling.
Two grandkids at home, little 4-year-old and a 1-year-old.
Yeah, can't beat that, can you?
It's the best.
My last question, Ian, is what are you looking forward to this week? What? Here we are at Augusta. We must finish on where we are.
Sure. I'm looking forward to another great championship, another great tournament. Masters always delivers. It's easier to pick the top 5 here, if you will, than any other major, I think.
Yeah.
I think having won here before, there's always the John Rahm and the Scotty Scheffler who's won the last couple of years. They will definitely be in the top 3 or 4.
Everybody thinks Scheffler's going to win. But you know, golf's not as simple as that. Greg Norman and anybody else would never win a Masters.
Correct. As many times as they had a chance, right? Yeah, so I think there's a chance that we might get the first rookie to win in Wyndham Clark. I know he's not really a rookie because he's the US Open champion, but it's his first time at the Masters. He could do it. You could look to a couple of youngsters like a Cam Young or a Will Zalatoris or a Ludvig Åberg to win because they've just got the game.
Yeah.
I really believe they have the game. Who I'd love to see win is Rory McIlroy.
Mm. Well, it's the best story this week.
I would love to see Rory
complete
win.
Complete the Grand Slam. It's the best story.
Complete the Grand Slam at the Masters.
He's a frustrating bugger to watch, though.
I've often said on TV.
Because the way he plays, you root for him instinctively.
I know. It's hard to be a Rory fan.
You know, no, don't hit it there. You know,
It's amazing how well he plays, how well he drives the ball. And he's a super young, I call him a kid, he's mid-30s now, but I've been around him since he came to Australia as a 17-year-old.
He's a good man. I like him from a journalistic point of view. I like Rory because he listens to the question and tries to answer the question.
He thinks about it.
He trot out the cliches. He tries to answer the question that you've asked. And as a journalist, you've got to love that.
Yeah, like Jeff Ogilvie. Jeff always thinks about his answers.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be interesting to see how he goes in TV, because you don't know, especially in US TV.
He's here
TV.
This week.
I know, we're doing for ESPN. Yeah. But I think he'll be in a studio role where you have more time to think and prepare.
Yeah.
Doing live golf is not easy.
He's not good at glib. I mean, he could do it. I mean, but he's very thoughtful, as you know, and he needs space and time to express himself.
Which you don't have.
Yeah.
I think Randall Chamblee does a great job. Frank Nobolo was the best at what he did when he was there with Randall. But you don't have that time to expand. You ask Frank a question, he'll tell you 10 answers. You know, he'll give you the way that he give you the way he got there that answer.
Yeah.
I was saying with Frank this week, and we always have great conversations. I do a lot of listening, but it's live golf is different, and the guys that get a chance to think about their answers and take their time. Brad Faxon's very good. And smart with his answers. So, but studio to live. And as you know, I'd love to be doing TV in the UK style or the Australian style, where it's a little more of a preamble and a little bit more of a... as we watch John Huggan make this putt at 17, let's get back to that story, Frank. Yeah. You know, it's a bit more slow.
That's right. Peter Alice was the perfect role.
I loved working with Peter.
Yeah.
Well, I worked with Peter for 8 years at ABC.
Yeah, so funny.
Yeah. And he just had a way with words. I admire the people that have that.
He learned from Longhurst, of course.
Yeah.
He was the master of the silence.
I think Dottie, too, by the way.
Dottie's terrific, yeah.
But she doesn't have a lot of time.
No. That's the downside of that role.
When Dottie says something, I was like Judy Rankin. When Dottie says something, it's worth hearing. And Judy Rankin was the same way. Not jumping in all the time, but when you get a chance, it's like she's rehearsed. She knows what's going on. Obviously a great player. So, yeah, I'm lucky to be in that team at CBS, that's for sure. How long it lasts, I don't know. Everything's getting younger.
Well, true enough, yeah.
And, you know, when we used to talk on TV, it's just, you go back to Henry Longhurst, Peter Alice, the people that we grew up watching, that was the only chance you had during the week to watch golf. And you fell on every word. And that was golf. That 3 or 4 hours on CBS on the weekends, that was golf. Mm. Now it's 24/7.
I know. Yeah. It's almost too much.
Social media, definitely too much. Mm. 10 times too much. Mm. Social media everywhere. Podcasts, which are interesting to listen to. I listen to yours. Listen to the one back home. Mm. Inside the Ropes, right? It's called the Australian one that Rod does. Mm. So I listen to a lot of them. Colt Nost does a great one. No laying up. They get a little bit abusive towards us sometimes, which I don't like. But I'm a bit soft when it comes to that stuff. But it's not just talking golf anymore. You know, there's a lot of noise.
Well, that's for people. You know, the point of these is always just to be like, and hopefully we've done it today. We've just had a conversation.
It's not been
me firing questions at you. You know, which is that's an interview. That's not a conversation.
No, it has been a conversation.
Yeah.
And then when I listen to it, I'll be cringing and holding my head thinking, why did I say that?
No.
But it's been just a great chat.
No, it's been – I've loved every minute. And
me too.
Thank you for your time, as always.
Yeah, no trouble. Let's do it again.
Well, you never know.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Ian.